When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Women to Watch is an intimate look into the lives of prominent and influential women leaders from around the world and the challenges they faced on their journey. It's the real story behind her title. Join us every week to hear more stories about women from around the world and in your own communities at womentowatch.net. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch. I'm Sue Rocco. Thanks so much for being with me. Joining me in just a moment will be Susanna Fox. And Susanna is the author of Rebel Health. And we're going to be talking about an opportunity that led Susanna to work with the President Obama administration as one of the first CTOs, Chief Technology Officer, bringing her expertise around health, anthropology, and technology. Don't forget to stay with us during the breaks where you'll hear from our exclusive watch team. And please do subscribe to our YouTube channel at W2W Media. So now I'm very honored to welcome to the show, Susanna Fox. Susanna, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I'm very much interested in the work that you're doing. It's so incredibly timely and important. And I thought I'd start off the interview with just having you describe for our viewers what you envision with a patient-led revolution in healthcare.
My vision of the future of healthcare is that at every level, patients, survivors, and caregivers are involved in the design and use and marketing of all the services and devices and treatments that they use. In this potential possible future, I would say scientists, entrepreneurs, investors, policymakers, everybody who has a stake in the future of healthcare consults with people with lived experience because they know that if they don't, they're not getting all the insight that they need.
And that would be everyone, right? Everyone, every one of us in some way or another is looking for guidance on so many levels.
Yeah. Mainstream healthcare really isn't getting that insight in the way that they could be.
Right. And there's a lot of things that need, I would say, and I don't know if you would agree with this, it feels very different post-COVID. Access to doctors and appointments and healthcare and information than it did before. So were you working on this prior?
Well, I have been collecting data and stories related to the patient-led revolution for over 20 years. And then during the pandemic shutdown, I actually finally had time to think about it in a systemic way and start to pull together this idea for a book. And thanks to MIT Press, who offered me the chance to write a book, I finally had my dream scenario of having both time and a place to write my book.
Yeah, it's so interesting when people talk about that time, and as horrific as it was, there was a positive for a lot of people that came out of it. You know, giving us time to kind of be introspective and But let me ask you a little bit about your background. And, you know, I wonder if, when you think about your upbringing, which was in the Philadelphia area, I'll say, I know you had a couple moves. What do you think it was about your upbringing that led you to this work?
That's a really interesting question. I would say that I come from storytellers on both sides of my family. I now know that that is a little bit unusual, that we would sit around after dinner, or my dad would sit on the porch with his two brothers and tell stories. And so I grew up listening very carefully to stories, and then realizing when I had stories of my own, that there's a certain way that you can tell stories, that there's a parable or a lesson. And I would say that had an effect on me.
Directly, I would say your mother was a writer, right? And dad was an engineer. Those are two very different parts of the brain.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. Tell me about, you know, traits that you see in yourself that perhaps have come from them.
My dad was somebody who loved code. He would, after dinner, could be found either reading a book of short stories, or could be found reading a book of code, literally like C++ code.
Oh my gosh. And my worst nightmare.
His love of technology and code was so infectious that it meant that I was unafraid of technology. And he was an early internet user and showed it to me back in the 1980s. Contrast that with my mom, who is a creative. She was a dance critic and a journalist. She worked actually as a dance critic for the Trenton Times. And I grew up going to dance concerts in Philadelphia and New Jersey and New York. And so she really honed this sense of creativity. And mom is somebody who dances like nobody's watching. She truly does.
Oh, I love that.
And there's just a freedom in that where so I had very much that sense of, being unafraid of technology and understanding the power of code, but also the love of words and creativity and art from my mom. Yeah.
You shared with me when we had our introductory call that you loved organizing things when you were growing up. How does that play into your life as an adult?
I still love to organize things. So I was sharing with you that I, as an 8-year-old, I reorganized the linen closet. I loved a label maker. And something that I was noticing recently, and I would love to actually ask you, I was noticing that most people, when I visit their homes, have a junk drawer in their kitchen. And I realized I don't have a junk drawer because in my opinion and in my life, everything has a place. And so can I ask you, are you the kind of person that everything has a place, or do you have a junk drawer?
I am exactly like you. I have what might be considered a junk drawer, but everything is organized and in its place in that drawer, to the point where people make fun of me for how neat and tidy my junk drawer is.
Yeah, I feel like I want to do a photo essay of like visiting people's houses and with their permission, taking a picture of their junk drawer to see what's in it. Because that's just like a life that I don't know. I'm a reaction child where if there was anything to organize as a kid, I would organize it. And so how that plays out now is, for example, I love to organize information. A lot of people hire someone else to write the index for their book. I loved it. I bought index cards. I loved writing the index for my book because I saw it as a user interface for the information that I was trying to convey. So I love to organize things and ideas.
Yeah. Would you that it's kind of an interesting topic for me, just because what does it say about the brain, people that need that organization? I believe for me, I feel more relaxed and calm in an organized space. But there are people who manage very well with things all over the place. and clutter. And, you know, it's just, I wonder when you think about why the organization is important to you, why do you think that is?
I think part of it is that I grew up in a pretty chaotic situation that, like, you know, in terms of like everything was stable, and yet things were kind of messy. My mom loved to read the newspaper. I think we got 3 daily newspapers in my house growing up. There was just a lot going on with 2 working parents, 3 kids in the household. And so my reaction to that was to become really organized. I also bet there's a spectrum, like introvert versus extrovert. And again, like I'm a very extroverted, organized person, and I have deep respect for disorganized introverts.
We have to learn to live with them. I am married to an extroverted, somewhat collector, messy boy. I don't know how to describe it, but we've managed to kind of help each other, you know, with how we deal with that. Tell me about, you went to Wesleyan University and studied anthropology. So it's interesting to me when I think about that, and here you ended up with a job with the United States Department of Health and Human Services in technology. So first, let me ask you, what were your aspirations when you made that decision to go to Wesleyan and study anthropology?
Well, I was somebody who loved every course that I took. I would take a literature class and say, oh, I'm going to be a literature major. I would take a geology class and say, oh, maybe I want to be a scientist, and on, you know, econ, history, et cetera. And then I found anthropology, which is a systematic way of looking at the world that made sense to me. Studying anthropology is also a license to be professionally and politely curious about other people. You learn to observe, and you can bring in all those other disciplines. You can bring in religious studies, history, econ. So in a way, it was a way to tie up all of my various interests into one major. And I also really liked the idea of getting a training in how to enter into a community that I'm not a member of and be professionally and politely curious about them.
Yeah. So when I think about your journey, you worked at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and you worked at US News.
I did.
Which I believe is where you first kind of discovered your love of technology and information that was available on the internet. Tell me about that discovery.
Yeah, so I was a startup kid in the 90s. I learned how to build websites, and that's how I spent most of the 90s. And I helped build the first website for U.S. News and World Report magazine, usnews.com, and indeed fell in love with how the internet could democratize access to information and data. People might remember and know that U.S. News is famous for rankings, ranking colleges, graduate schools, hospitals, et cetera. And we on the web team decided that a useful tool for the website would be to allow students and their parents to re-rank the schools according to what's important to them. We took all of the data that the editors collected to create the rankings for the colleges, and we created a tool online that basically you could say, I want to live in the Midwest and I want to play these 3 sports or major in these 3 things, and it would re-rank the schools if you just want to stay in the Midwest. And this was pretty radical, and the editors, basically it was proceed until apprehended was the way that we conducted ourselves on the web team, because most of the print editors in 1995, 1996, they weren't yet paying attention to the website in the way that, of course, they did just a few years later when everything really exploded and everyone was using the internet.
How did you land that particular job?
I answered an ad for an internship. I had a year of working for an internet startup in 1994. This is, I like to say, when dinosaurs roamed the internet. I had worked for real networks and decided that I really wanted to apply my internet skills to journalism and wanted to see what we could do with a website for a newspaper or a magazine. And I applied for and got a $10 an hour internship at US News because they weren't sure how much they were going to invest in the digital technologies that were available. And I'm happy to say that the editors then saw the promise of it. And I kept getting promoted until I became the editor of the website 5 years later.
Wow. Wow. Was there anyone there that you would say was a mentor for you, someone who kind of believed in you and saw your abilities beyond the young woman coming in for an internship?
Thank you for asking that question. What a great opportunity to shout out some very special people to me. Bill Allman was an editor at the magazine and was someone who saw the promise of the internet early, and he was a big advocate for expanding what the website could do. Amy Bernstein is another journalist who has gone on to work at Harvard Business Review and has an incredible podcast herself, actually, and saw my early promise and was a wonderful mentor and friend. And Lee Rainey, who was an editor at the magazine, and then he left to start the Pew Internet and American Life Project and brought me along with him. And when I switched gears and became a researcher, it was thanks to Lee, who had been an editor at US News.
Okay, so that was your next move then. What was your role there as far as the research? What were you working on?
Well, working at the Pew Internet Project was like working for a startup company. It was really the beginning of looking at the social impact of the internet on American society. We started in the year 2000, and our bread and butter was national survey data, when people actually used to answer their landline telephones and answer questions from pollsters. And I brought in my anthropology background and started doing field work in online communities because I got advice from another mentor, Tom Ferguson, who said, if you're going to be studying the intersection of technology and healthcare, don't hang out with doctors, don't hang out with health policy mavens, hang out with cancer survivors, hang out with the mothers and fathers of children with rare diseases, because they will tell you where the future is heading, because they're the pioneers building on the frontiers of health and technology. I took his advice and used my anthropology degree to start doing that kind of field work.
Yeah, so that sounds like the beginning of kind of a light bulb moment for you, right? And seeing what could be, focusing more efforts and paying attention to what patients, survivors, right, were going through. We're going to take our first break. And when we come back, I want to hear a little bit about your time working under the Obama administration in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Service. Stay with us for our Watch Team segments, and I'll be back with Susanna Fox.
Hi, my name is Christy McCaffrey. I'm the founder and owner of Be the Good Media, and I'm here to share some good news with you. Today, I wanted to share with you about a guest that I had on my podcast named Jen Welby Gilbert. Jen is an elementary school teacher who says that she wants her students to know that they are never too young to make a difference and that they have the ability to change the world. After years of implementing her own program in her classroom to help her students understand the process and the value of giving and philanthropy, Jen went on to create her own nonprofit called The Giving Project for Children, where she's now created a curriculum that she shares with parents, teachers, and administrators to help encourage the study of philanthropy and giving in classrooms. How inspiring is that? That is some good news. To hear more of our conversation, you can visit bethegoodmedia.com. And there you'll also learn more about how Be the Good Media works to amplify impact-driven missions and causes. Again, I'm Christy McCaffrey. Listen here for more good news on Women to Watch.
Dear CEO, board director, and executive mentor to Fortune 500 executives through my work at the EXCO Group, firm of experienced CEOs, board directors, and global business leaders who offer real-world experience to help organizations and senior leaders grow. Today on Leadership Watch, we're going to talk about being in the driver's seat of your career. No matter what stage you're at in your career, you need to grasp that you are in the driver's seat. Understanding from day one that you and you alone are responsible for your career is critical. After all, why would you hand your career over to someone else to manage? There's no one as vested in yourself as you. And the ugly truth is that most managers are focused on execution rather than team development. So how can you ensure that your career stays on track? First, make sure you have a clear set of agreed upon goals that are measurable, and if priorities shift, rewrite them with buy-in. Two, if you see something that can be improved upon or automated, don't wait to be asked, just do it. This is good advice for tech-savvy millennials and Gen Zs who can help lead the way with AI. Three, don't insulate yourself. Get to know other parts of the organization and network both internally and externally. Feel free to drive outside of your lane. And four, while your career is yours to own, don't go it alone. Identify sponsors and mentors. Also, it's important to make self-reflection and self-assessment a habit. Think through where you want to be 5 years from now and create a roadmap for yourself. Does your current path get you there? Are you passionate about what you're doing? Do you feel challenged? Are you learning? Do you feel respected? And importantly, are you a cultural fit? And is the company a cultural fit for you? If you answer negative to any of these questions, it's likely time for some course correcting. Please follow me on LinkedIn at Dawn Zier. And if you're a senior executive looking to grow in your career, check out expoleadership.com to learn more.
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined this week by Susanna Fox. And Susanna is the author of Rebel Health. And Susanna, I wanted to talk to you in this next segment a little bit about your role as the Chief Technology Officer for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services under the Obama administration. And my first question is just, what were you doing? What was the job?
I ran an open data and innovation lab, which served all the operating divisions of HHS, from discovery at the National Institutes of Health to regulation at FDA to healthcare delivery at Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and Indian Health Services to public health and all of the data that is collected at the Centers for Disease Control. What we in the office of the CTO tried to do was shine a light on the path forward of open data that citizens, everyone should have access to the data that the government collects. And we also taught federal workers how to think like entrepreneurs, which was such an awesome opportunity to work directly with people on the front lines of these federal agencies.
Yeah. So who spearheaded this particular project?
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper. distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
So the idea for the Office of the Chief Technology Officer was actually a brainchild of President Obama himself. He knew that healthcare was going to be a big part of his agenda going in. And he also wanted to bring the spirit of Silicon Valley, the spirit of technology into both the White House and at HHS. So he created these positions, which had never existed before, the Chief Technology Officer at the White House and the Chief Technology Officer position at HHS. And I want to pause and say, there, of course, had always been a chief information officer, a CIO, who made sure that their the email worked and the servers were all running. It was the CTO that brought in this spirit of open data and innovation and entrepreneurship.
Okay. Did you have an opportunity to work directly with the president?
No. So Todd Park was the first CTO at HHS, and he was recruited directly by President Obama to set up the office for the first time. Brian Sivek was the second CTO at HHS, and I was the third. I was the cleanup batter for the Obama administration.
Okay.
And actually, what I'm eager to say that when we handed off the portfolio during the transition to the Trump administration, it was a seamless transition. There were many things that the Trump administration chose not to continue from the Obama administration, but the office of the CTO is something that continued. And I had a great working relationship with both Bruce Greenstein and Ed Simcox, who served in the Trump administration as HHS CTO.
Okay. I think I saw in my research that the position is open right now. So is that right?
Yeah. Okay. No, it's such great news.
Do you want to go back? Are you allowed?
So what I am super excited about is that the Biden administration and all of the federal workers, as you know, when a new administration comes in, it's kind of like the top of the wedding cake gets taken off and a new top goes on. The whole rest of the wedding cake are federal workers. Those are the people who really get the work done. And it's only a small group of people who change during a presidential transition. And what they decided to do, the Biden administration, in consultation with the federal worker leadership at HHS, is they realized that the office of the CTO is so important that it should be not a political position, but a standard protected federal worker position. And so they created that. It's a new position that's indeed open. And I'm super proud and excited. And all five of us who were political appointees as HHS CTO are totally in favor of this change.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I wanted to talk to you about, you know, there's a phrase I guess you use in your work, and you say peer-to-peer advice. And I was curious if there was a moment when you recognized the power of that, and, you know, which led to the book, and we'll talk about that as well. But
thank you. Yes. When I was doing field work in communities of people living with rare diseases and life-changing diagnoses, what I noticed is that they would often turn to each other for advice. They always turn to a doctor for diagnosis, for treatment options, but they would turn to each other if they hit a dead end and a clinician couldn't help them. And so often the kind of advice that people really need is day-to-day advice. So, you know, what dietary changes can you make that would help a child? What are people's, you know, ideas, and I call them hacks, for something like a physical challenge, like a dexterity challenge, or someone with low vision? There are all kinds of ways that people adapt their homes and experiment in what we think of as personal science or N of one trials at home to try and make their life better. And those ideas were being traded peer to peer on messaging boards and early social media sites. And again, I'm thinking here about how my dad taught me about the structure of the internet. The structure of the internet is peer to peer. And so instead of being the old model of technology where there was a single server and all the other client technology flowed from that, the internet is peer to peer. And I realized that that is the community that people were building themselves to fill in the gaps where mainstream healthcare was failing them. That peer-to-peer healthcare would create that safety net for people. And so I coined that phrase in, I think it was the year 2007. And once I realized that this was happening, I started to see it everywhere. I started to see it in cancer survivorship. I started to see it in more common conditions like heart disease or recovery from stroke or diabetes. And that's when I realized that this is this undercurrent, this river of knowledge and experience that is flowing underneath, outside the view of mainstream healthcare, that we really need to tap into.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me, because when I think about what people, and again, it's everyone faces some kind of a health issue, there's so much trial and error. So much when a doctor has reached the point where they don't know what else this person can do. So when you're referring to, you started to see this online, are you referencing communities where people come together? So if you have diabetes, there's a website and a community for people with diabetes, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. If what I like to say to people is, no matter what you are dealing with, if you are a caregiver with someone with dementia, if you are newly diagnosed, or if you're not yet diagnosed, if you're experiencing symptoms that are mysterious, whatever health challenge you are dealing with, please know that you are not alone. There are people who would love to help you if only they knew how to find you. And there are communities who would love to share their maps of the healthcare maze that we all find ourselves in at one time or another. And they really are knitting together the safety net that catches people when they fall through the cracks.
Mm. I wanted to talk to you about, really at the core of your work is trying to bring together executives in the healthcare system with patients. And what kind of feedback are you receiving from the C-suite executives and the doctors with the work that you're doing?
Well, I'm happy to say that there's a lot of curiosity and positive feedback, that once executives understand how much patients want to help, patients and survivors and caregivers, people with lived experience are ready to contribute their ideas. They are ready to share how a device or a service delivery could be improved. And that this is generally a positive reaction from executives, especially entrepreneurs and investors, who really see that while there is a lot of suffering, that also is a lot of opportunity for new businesses, new ideas. And I'm excited to see how people are able to start to tap into the patient-led revolution. For me, all I see is upside.
Something that those of us outside of the healthcare system, I think we have seen a lot of change and we're worried, you know, just about the lack of ability to get an appointment, hear from a doctor, you know, it's changed a great deal. And I wanted to ask you, what do you worry about, if at all, about our healthcare system, and what are you hopeful for?
I am worried about access. I'm worried about access, particularly to mental health treatment. Access to primary care, which is the baseline for health. And I'm also worried about how much anger there is. When I am speaking to a more general public audience, like at a bookstore or an event that is open to the public, to contrast with when I'm speaking to a corporate audience or a scientific audience, where there's a lot of positive curiosity, on the side of the public, there's a lot of anger. And in fact, some people have come to a book event and they see the title Rebel Health and they hear Patient-Led Revolution, and they actually want like a pitchforks revolution against the American healthcare system. And I keep saying, no, like my revolution is about treatment and device innovation. You're going to want to be part of my revolution too. And it worries me to when I see so much free-floating anger about all the ways that mainstream healthcare is failing us. And what I hope is that people see that there are possibilities for change, that they, again, are not alone, that they don't have to solve every problem themselves. There are likely people who have walked this path before them. And if we have the courage to raise our hand and say we need help in our community, whether it's our offline community or online community, there so often is someone who will come to your aid and give you that advice that you need.
Yeah, I would imagine that the anger is more a frustration that stems from all of the misinformation. So we don't know what to trust in information. And, you know, that's a very tough thing. And I think it's a big part of it. By the way, you're a mother. You have two children.
I do.
Two or three? You have
just
two children.
Just two. Happy to say just two.
When you think about them and, you know, the world is so incredibly different from when we grew up, there is an abundance of information coming at us and to our children. And, you know, what do you hope for them? What change would you most like to see for them as they grow up and go out into the world?
Well, what I like to say is we try to raise our kids to be independent. And dang it, they are so independent. Sometimes I don't know where they are or what they're doing next. And I hope that they can keep that sense of confidence and independence and individuality that they have now at age 20 and 23. I would love to see them forge their own path and have the confidence, frankly, like I did, to jump into a new field and learn new things. I could not have predicted the career that I have. Looking back, everyone tells a great story in retrospect. But what I try to teach them is work with people you admire, be curious, and keep learning new things every day.
That's very good advice. Let's quickly talk about the book, Rebel Health. And I guess my two questions would be, first, number one, what made you decide to write it, because, you know, writing a book is a huge endeavor. It takes a long time. It takes a lot of work. So when did you make that decision, and what do you hope people will most get from it?
I felt a sense of responsibility for the thousands of people who answered survey questions when I was at the Pew Research Center, and really the thousands of people who shared their personal stories with me in all the fieldwork projects that I did. So many people have amazing ideas about how to improve healthcare. And it felt like C.S. Lewis has this wonderful phrase that he said, he wrote to a friend once, "I am with book as a woman is with child." And that's how I felt about my book, this sense of responsibility for all of the stories and insights that had been shared with me over the years. I couldn't not write the book, is how I felt.
You were meant to do it. It's part of why you're here, would you say?
Yeah. And what's funny about a book, somebody said, "Oh, you're a technology person. Why don't you just do, videos on TikTok, or, you know, and send your message out in that way?" There's something about a book. There's something about still drawing together all of your evidence, choosing, by the way, which stories to feature, because for every one story that I included in the book, I have two more. And also being forced to come up with a way of describing what I'm trying to say and what I see in the world, describing that in 200 pages. And I want to say, if anybody picks up my book, I have a couple tips. I designed the book for people who are tired. I was thinking about caregivers. I was thinking about patients. I was thinking about very busy executives. And there are lots of illustrations. There's lots of stories. And at the end of every chapter, I have a summary box of what you learned
like
in this chapter.
Yes. I like how you broke that down very much. I like that.
Yeah. So I was thinking of people with brain fog, and I tried to make it fun and easy to understand what's happening in the patient-led revolution.
Yeah. And I think it will give people a sense of hope as well.
I hope so too. Thank you.
Knowing that they have the power, right, to be a part of the change.
Yes, exactly. Step into your power.
Yeah. My last question for you is about stress and anxiety. You have a very calm demeanor. You seem very relaxed, and you know, that's your energy. So I leave our listeners and viewers with some advice on, I'm sure you have days where things go awry, and what do you say to yourself to ground you again?
Slow down. When things start to get crazy, slow down. If you are doing too many things at once, you're going to drop something, you're going to forget something. And so the more things get chaotic, the slower I will make decisions and the slower I will respond to things. And by doing that, you are taking back a little bit of your power. Otherwise, if things start to spin out of control, you are giving up your power to keep things in control.
Yeah, that's really great advice, because it used to be that multitasking was kind of this badge of honor. I'm able to multitask. And I think we are discovering that it's much more, the right thing to do is to take life slow.
Yeah, and I'll also say, I'm no good after 9 p.m. So I never once pulled an all-nighter at college.
Oh, so nor did I.
I
talk
was
about
always,
brain fog. Yes.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So I was always super organized and just got stuff done, which, gosh, that sounds so boring. But it was the only way that I could live, putting order into the chaos.
Yeah, yeah. And we need that today more than ever, for sure. Susanna, thank you so much for being on the show. I enjoyed our conversation and appreciate your time.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're going to go into our last break for our watch team, and I'll be back to close out the show.
We are CHOP, and we can't wait to show you around. We're the nation's first children's hospital. Now, a care network with more than 50 locations that continues to expand. 3 state-of-the-art research buildings with 1.5 million square feet of space. We have grown from 12 beds 165 years ago to nearly 600 beds and one of the best children's hospitals in the world. We have a level 1 trauma center, 11 floors of patient units, more than 20 operating rooms, first of its kind delivery unit for babies with birth defects, a separate cardiac operative and catheterization suite, and places to learn, like our internationally recognized simulation center. We have trained generations of leaders in the field of pediatrics. We are world leaders in medicine, surgery, and science. One of the top recipients in NIH funding for pediatric research. In this building, pioneers in CAR T therapy, mitochondrial disease, brain tumors, hyperinsulinism, and other rare diseases. Here, groundbreaking work in fetal surgery, genetics and genomics, and neurology. In our newest building, leaders in social determinants of health, clinical informatics and epidemiology, autism, trauma and injury prevention. Our patients come from every state and 115 countries. Meeting these challenges requires the best and the brightest. We are passionate about pediatrics. We are motivated to make a difference in the world and in our community. We are a team. We are CHOP.
That's it, everyone, for another week of Women to Watch. Thanks so much for tuning in. Next week, I'll be sitting down with Atiya Abawi, and she is a former international correspondent who spent 5 years reporting from Afghanistan. Thank you, as always, to our watch team of corporate partners, and I hope you all have a great week.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.